I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we hear about one courageous young journalist and her fight to give a voice to the tens of thousands of victims of the long war in the Congo. But first, from time to time, we like to catch up with NPR's foreign correspondents to talk about what they're doing and how they're doing. Ophelia Quist-Arkton has spent the last year covering some of Africa's most complex and challenging stories, from Guinea to Senegal, from Nigeria to Ghana. And we're pleased to have her with us in our studios to check in and share some of the highlights of her last year. Ophelia, welcome. Welcome back. It's good to see you.
Lovely to be back here. Has it been a year already?
Yes, it has. Now, I hate to start on such a disturbing note, but when we last heard from you last month, you had just traveled to Guinea in West Africa. On September 28th, more than 50,000 people had gathered in an opposition rally in the capital of Conakry when presidential guards opened fire on the crowds, killing more than 150 people, according to human rights groups. Now, the government says 57 were killed, but even more shocking than the shootings, as you reported, were the rapes of scores of women in broad daylight. And you were saying that these rapes had shaken the country. You spoke with some of the survivors in Guinea. I just want to play a short clip of what one of them told you.
I don't want to give my name in the radio because they know us all. I am a teacher. I am in that place where they do us rough. And I saw the soldier men beat the policemen, beat the women, tear their clothes and their trousers, took a knife and dug it in the women. Even I, they do it. I'm so afraid.
And of course, she found out this woman was actually talking about herself.
You know, what I hadn't realized when I was with the women was that they weren't all survivors of rape. Some of them had witnessed all sorts of atrocities in the stadium. And Guinea is a Muslim country. It is very conservative, Michelle. So, of course, this woman, although they were all women and were all going to be sympathetic, didn't want other women to know she had been raped. So it was the guidance counselor who said to me afterwards, all those things she was telling you, that happened to her. That was, you know, I felt so bad. So after that, I kept, you know, I made reasons for why other women should walk out. And I said, I need quiet to record and so on.
Do you have any sense of how this started and why this started? And is there any history of this behavior in Guinea? We're going to hear in a couple of minutes from another journalist working in the Congo who's been documenting the stories of women and girls, some 200,000 women and girls in the eastern region of Congo that who we believe who have been brutalized in the war there since 1998. But in Guinea,
security forces firing on civilians, yes. Rape of women, yes, but not in broad daylight on a Monday morning at noon, Michelle. And a lot of people were saying to me in Guinea, said, you jamais vu. In French, that means we have never witnessed this before. And they're saying, you know, a lot of women, a lot of people are saying it's the security forces making the capital Conakry into almost a combat zone, a conflict zone, to try and control women and to silence them. So it's the same sort of phenomenon that we've been seeing in eastern Congo over recent years.
Is there any sign that the perpetrators will be held accountable? I mean, Guinea's military leader is indeed the commander-in-chief of these forces. He's the leader of the country. Is there any sign that any accountability is being demanded?
There's a lot of pressure, Michelle. There's a lot of pressure from within Guinea, from within West Africa, from within the African Union. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has said there must be no impunity this time and that Captain Moussa Dadis Camara must step down. He's the military leader, that the other junta leaders must also be held to account, and the soldiers, and especially the women in Guinea, are saying, pas d'impunité cette fois-ci. No impunity this time. We want justice.
Moving now to a different topic, President Obama visited Ghana in July. This was his first official trip to sub-Saharan Africa. And of course, with his African roots, his Kenyan father, there was some excitement over his visit. Let's listen to a song that was written in his honor.
President Barack Obama, welcome to Ghana. His Excellency, President Atanos, and the Ghana Fujama.
Now, you traveled to Accra for his visit. What was the reaction?
Ha-ha, you know, it was coming to my home, so it was most exciting. It was especially exciting, I think, for Ghanaians to welcome the whole of the Obama family, because a lot of people say Michelle Obama comes from the Fanti Coast. She feels that she does, they say, and it was lovely to welcome the children as well. And I think Ghanaians felt it was a real privilege. It was the US and Washington saying, yes, Ghana, you're on the right track.
What about the rest of the continent? Did the visit register there?
Oh, yes.
Elsewhere?
All over. Although Ghana was the chosen country that President Obama visited, I think a lot of Africans all over the continent felt Ghanaian that way, because they felt that, this is the first black African-American president, and he has chosen to come to Africa.
If you're just joining us, I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with NPR's West Africa correspondent, Ophibia Quist-Darkin. We're taking a peek into her reporter's notebook, and we're talking about some of the news highlights that she's reported on over the past year. I think one of the highlights for many of our listeners will be the series that you did in August on emerging cultural voices from Africa. You profiled different artists throughout the continent. The first you spoke with is Lebo
Mashile.
Okay, here you go.
Yeah.
Let's play just a short clip. She represents the Born Frees, the young generation of post-apartheid South Africa. Here she is performing The Ancient Ones. Here it is.
The ancient ones plait their stories into the futures of their children. The ancient ones, they use their hands to heal the backs of broken men. And I hold a pen for every ancient who dared not hold a fist against the tyranny that sucked the life and hope out of her breasts.
Exciting.
Isn't she?
Yeah.
30 years old, Michelle. She is not only a poet and a writer. She presents radio shows. She hosts television shows. She is, the promise of South Africa for me, this young woman, Lebo Mashile. And she's not the only one. There are a lot of them. But she's also a really thinking, deep young woman, saying that we are the product of what our parents, our aunts, our uncles, the older generations, they fought for. They struggled. So we mustn't just take post-apartheid South Africa freedom, liberation for granted. Marvelous.
Is spoken word very popular in South Africa?
Becoming bigger and bigger and bigger, yeah.
Another emerging voice you highlighted is the rapper Didier Awadi from Senegal. And here is Awadi performing. Let's play a short clip.
Our music is for us a weapon of mass education to fight all the injustice that we face everywhere, every day. It's high time for us to rebuild our soul. So that's why we say positive black soul, show another image of Africa, to force everybody not to look at us with pity, and all Africans must be proud of what we are. We have good reason to be proud of Africa.
And what language does he perform in?
He speaks Wolof, French, English, you name it. The young people in Africa these days are absolute polyglots. They speak every language. But as you hear, he is very, very, very proficient in English. What I really liked about Awadi, apart from being a rapper and a musician, he talks to a lot of very young people. He says to young Africans, young Senegalese, don't get on rickety boats and try and get to Europe and North America. Try and rebuild your own countries. We are the ones. We are the next generation. If we disappear, what is going to happen to our countries?
And he's not tempted himself. I mean, one of the people who are often sort of the ambassadors for a country are the cultural workers, the artists, musicians. They're often the first ones to leave.
Absolutely not. He is rooted in Senegal, travels a hell of a lot, all over the continent, all over the world, and, rapping, bringing the message and so on. But he says he's going nowhere. Senegal is his country.
And finally, one more fascinating story from Senegal that you brought us involved a board game that hopes to encourage the creation of the United States of Africa. Tell us about it.
The inventor is called Salif Tijamba. And what he says he wants through this game is to teach young African people, African school children, and those who are interested in Africa, that it's only together that the continent is going to move forward. So it's a bit of a complicated game, Michelle, but it has questions, and it also has sages, the wise leaders of Africa. Now, you'd think those would be who? Nelson Mandela, founding father of African Pan-Africanism, Kwame Nkrumah and so on. But he also has people like Muammar Gaddafi and, a controversial leader, the leader of Libya. We asked him, well, why? And he said, well, anyone who is fighting for Africa to be united can be considered a sage.
So maybe I'll put it on my Christmas list.
Try. It's coming out in English soon.
Well, it's always good to see you, Ophibia. Thank you for stopping by. Any plans you can share with us for the next few months, what you're going to be looking at?
The continent, as usual. I think immediately the climate change conference in Copenhagen, an African angle. And then we shall see, as always, all over Africa.
Ophibia Quist-Darkin is NPR's West Africa correspondent. She was kind enough to stop by our Washington, D.C. studios. And Fabia, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Speak to you soon.